Lecture 24, Wang Yangming, The Study of Heart-Mind.
Hello, I'm delighted to be with you again. In this lecture, we'll be picking up the story of Neo-Confucianism by talking about some of Zhu Xi's more practical accomplishments. Zhu Xi served for several years as an official, and in that capacity, he was responsible for improving agriculture, for setting up charitable granaries, for organizing famine relief, for overseeing the administration of justice. It would have been difficult for scholar officials in the Song Dynasty to remain cloistered in ivory towers, because the very ethos of Confucianism, with its concern for the welfare of the common people, it encouraged an activist form of philosophy. I want to talk about Zhu Xi's education ideas to begin with. He realized that it was difficult for ordinary people to live their lives according to the record of ritual. Okay, that's one of those five Confucian classics, and it, by his time, is 1,500 years old, and it was originally written for aristocrats in pre-imperial China. So Zhu Xi wrote the book Family Rituals, which updated the classic to meet the needs of contemporary families with regard to weddings and funerals and ancestral rites and so forth. The ceremonies it detailed were simpler, they were less costly than what was in the record of ritual, and they were easier to actually put into practice, which means that more people were able to live in this very Confucian sort of way. He did something similar for Confucianism in general when he advocated replacing the detailed study of the five Confucian classics, okay, quick review, the venerated documents, the classic of poetry, the Spring and Autumn Annals, that was a history of Confucius' state of Lu, the record of ritual, and the classic of change, or I Ching. Okay, he substituted the five classics with a much smaller set of key Confucian texts that he called the four books. This is the Analects, the Mencius, we've seen both of those before, and then the Doctrine of the Mean and the Great Learning. The last two are actually chapters, single chapters, from the record of ritual that Zhu Xi rearranged and then put into logical order. So now, rather than having to master several thousand pages of difficult ancient prose, students could focus on a couple hundred relatively easy pages. And the four books tended to focus on morality and self-cultivation. You probably remember that from the Confucian Analects. Okay, one of the new texts, the Doctrine of the Mean, speaks of balance and harmony, sincerity, the unity between heaven and man. But I want to give a little more attention to the Great Learning, which sets forth a program of spiritual development that can benefit the entire world. It opens in this way, with a passage that was cited both by Han Yu in his essay on the essentials of the moral way, remember about the Tao, the Confucian Tao, and also the Cheng brothers talked about this particular chapter. And I want you to watch how it starts big and then sort of drills down to the smallest level and then it comes back up again. It's kind of a long quotation, so bear with me here, but you'll get the idea of what's happening. It says, "The ancients who wished to illustrate illustrious virtue throughout the world first ordered their own kingdoms. Wishing to order well their kingdoms, they first regulated their families. Wishing to regulate their families, they first cultivated their persons. Wishing to cultivate their persons, they first rectified their hearts." Okay, you're waiting for the end here. You're getting smaller and smaller to what's going to be the core issue here. Let's see, we're at hearts. "Wishing to rectify their hearts, they first sought to be sincere in their thoughts. Wishing to be sincere in their thoughts, they first extended to the utmost their knowledge. Such extension of knowledge lay in the investigation of things." Okay, and that's where it ends. And then it picks up again. So things being investigated, knowledge becomes complete. Their knowledge being complete, their thoughts are sincere. Their thoughts being sincere, their hearts are then rectified. Can you see that we're doing the same order, but backwards now? Their hearts being rectified, their persons were cultivated. Their persons being cultivated, their families were regulated. Their families being regulated, the kingdoms were rightly governed. Their kingdoms being rightly governed, the whole world was tranquil and happy. Okay, so you can see that, you know, if you want to have a good kingdom, you have a good family. If you want to have a good family, you work on yourself, and it goes from there, right? So here you've got politics and family relationships and psychology and self-cultivation and ethics all tied together in a rational, logical progression. In his commentary, Jushi explained each step of this process, but the crux of the matter is clearly the investigation of things. That's the pivot that everything hinges on. Now, one might hope that this investigation of things would lead to a scientific-type analysis, but Jushi was primarily interested in human affairs. So we recommended that his students study history and morality. Actually, there was a huge history written just before Jushi that incorporated all of Chinese history, and Jushi makes a compendium of that, sort of an easier version to get through so that you can more easily study morality as it's experienced in history. And by studying those kinds of things, that's how you could come to know the Li. Remember, that's the principle with a capital P in all things. Jushi also recommended that book study be broken up with periods of quiet sitting, in which a person might just sit still and ponder his situation or some idea or some fact, something they just learned. So book study in the morning and then a little quiet sitting in the afternoon would be good. Now, this isn't quite like the emptying one's mind kind of meditation recommended by Buddhists, but it does seem to have a lot in common with the practice of Zen. Jushi was a controversial thinker in his own day, but his ideas became the new orthodoxy a little over a century later. Okay, now, how did that happen? In 1313, it was decreed that the civil service exams from then on would be based on the four books and Jushi's commentaries to them. So they weren't just studied, they were memorized by everyone in China who was educated. This is a big deal. The imperial exam system in China has been called one of the greatest achievements of Chinese civilization. Okay, so think of it. There's a government that's staffed by the most intelligent, most diligent, most educated men in the country. And because the exams were based on the Confucian classics, there was an assumption that those who had mastered them were also the most moral and public-minded of men as well. Okay, no women are taking the exams or going into office, sorry. There were some other paths to public office through the military or official sponsorship, if you happen to have a relative or a friend who could make a recommendation, family connections. But the most prestigious positions were given to those who passed the exams. There were three levels of tests. At the local level, where maybe 1 to 10% of the candidates passed, and then it went to the metropolitan level at the capital, and again, only about 10% passed there. And then there was a palace exam that was overseen by the emperor himself. Most people passed there, and then they were ranked by the order that they came in and on the exam. Examiners worked hard to make these as fair as possible. So the papers were identified only by a number rather than by a name. They were copied over by clerks so that the calligraphy couldn't be recognized by the judges. And then they were evaluated by three judges, each exam essay was. And the system seemed to have worked fairly well. In the Song Dynasty, about 200 men each year were moved into senior government positions after passing the highest level of the civil service exams. It's the Jinshi exam. We'll call it a doctorate. And of those men who passed the exam, went into office, more than half of them came from families which had not had anyone in the civil service for the past three generations. So there's an opportunity for social mobility here. You're getting new people, new families into government. Partly, this is the result of the fact that China doesn't have primogeniture at this time. Now, in medieval Europe, a father would give all of his territory, his land, his feudal holdings, to his oldest son. Because otherwise, if you've got four sons, you divide your property four ways, they each have four sons, and in two generations, it's down to a 16th of what it once was. They don't have that primogeniture in China, so the property does get divided unless people do something to gain more power, to gain more property, to add to the family wealth. And that's where the exams come in. So that merchants would buy land, and then they would educate their sons. And then their sons have to be successful in this degree program. Otherwise, the family will sort of fall out of the elite class. Men took these civil service exams several times. They were very difficult. And the doctorate degree was typically obtained in one's mid-30s. In fact, biographical dictionaries in China use the date that you get your doctorate degree, your Jean-Sher degree, and as the beginning point, and then a death date afterwards. So it's not a, you don't get a birth date and a death date, because they say, you know, you're, what's the big deal about being born? Everybody's born. But it's when you pass the exams. That's when your real life begins, your public life, when you start to matter enough to be in a biographical dictionary. Okay, but this account that I've given you of the civil service exams, it doesn't begin to give you a sense of what was at stake. Because the exams were the primary path to success and to power and to celebrity, national attention was focused on them, such as today we might give to film stars or to sports heroes. So taking these exams is not so much like taking the SATs as it is like winning an Olympic gold medal or winning on American Idol. Suddenly the offers start pouring in for people who want to marry their daughters to you, people want to be your friends, people want to know you, have some association with you. So placing first in the exams made you famous. And the competition was intense. At the beginning of the Song Dynasty, about 30,000 men started this process of taking these exams at the lowest level. At the end of the dynasty, it had risen to about 400,000 men were all competing to win in these exams. And it's for the same number of offices. That doesn't change through the dynasty. People were paranoid about cheating. So in the late imperial era, the exams took between 24 and 72 hours. So this goes on for 3 days and 2 nights. And each candidate was locked in a tiny, completely enclosed exam room with a water pitcher, maybe a little bit of food, a chamber pot, some ink and brushes to write answers to the questions, and then two boards. And you could set them up so that they could be a seat and a desk so you could write on. And then when you got exhausted, you could put them down on the same level and then sleep on them. And then, you know, got up and tried to do some more. If somebody died during the exams, they just threw the body over the compound wall, right? No communication with the outside world is what they want. No one coming in and going out. From 1313 until the exams were discontinued in 1905, they go that long, Zhu Xi's four books and his commentaries at them were at the heart of this system. Every educated gentleman had spent years studying them and memorizing them. Even the starting date is significant. Zhu Xi died in 1200, and the Song Dynasty fell in 1279 to the Mongols. Now, you've heard of Genghis Khan, and his first impulse on conquering China was to burn all of the cities, to kill all of the people, and to turn China into pasture land for the Mongols' horses. He had an advisor who was half Chinese, half nomadic, who pointed out that the Chinese would pay more in taxes alive than dead. So he said, why don't you just set up a Chinese-style government and have the Chinese pay taxes to you instead? So that's what the Mongols do. They have a Chinese type of government. It's going to be called the Yuan Dynasty, and it's complete with an emperor on the throne who is Genghis Khan's grandson, Kublai Khan. But there weren't that many Mongols, and there were a lot of Chinese. So the Mongols needed Chinese administrators to help govern the empire. So where do you get these administrators from? Eventually, they reinstate the exams in order to recruit officials. And they base the exams on Zhu Xi's type of Confucianism, right? As if the Mongols cared about Confucian virtues. But there's apparently, you know, only one way that you can rule China. Neo-Confucianism was probably more tightly connected to imperial rule than even Han Dynasty Confucianism had been many centuries earlier. But wherever there's orthodoxy, there will always be people who question it. The most important alternate version of Neo-Confucianism is that of Wang Yangming. He was a scholar official of the Ming Dynasty. So the Ming Dynasty goes from 1368 to 1644. This is a native Chinese dynasty that replaced the Mongols when they kicked out the Mongols. It's also the dynasty that built the Great Wall that you see today if you go to China. Even though the original fortifications go back to the first emperor in the Qin Dynasty, what you'll actually see was built in the 15th century. Wang Yangming lived from 1472 to 1529. Sort of an unusual child, he didn't start speaking until he was about 6. He was a brilliant student, however, and he studied Zhu Xi's Neo-Confucianism, but he also studied Buddhism and Taoism and military affairs, including strategy and horsemanship and archery. He was apparently a fairly good archer. After passing the civil service exams, Wang Yangming became the governor of a province, as well as a military commander who put down several rebellions, including one particular massive rebellion. At one point, he was put in charge of military and logistical affairs for 5 southern provinces. Although Wang Yangming had mastered the 4 classics and their commentaries, he nevertheless found Zhu Xi's emphasis on the investigation of things somewhat unsatisfying. He and some of his friends once tried to learn through Zhu Xi's recommended method of quiet sitting. So they want to find out about bamboo and what the principle of bamboo is, the li. So they went to a bamboo grove and they sat down and they started meditating. And then one by one, Wang Yangming's friends gave up and left, though he held out for a week until he became physically ill. In the end, however, he didn't feel like he'd really learned anything at all. It just wasn't working for him. And then at the age of 36, at a time when he was exiled down in southwest China, Wang Yangming had a sudden insight. And the insight was that true knowledge was innate. People don't have to acquire knowledge, they're born with it. And this innate knowledge can be recovered through study. And you also need to put aside selfish desire, and that will help you gain this. But the more direct route to this innate knowledge is introspection. So Zhu Xi had argued that there was a difference between li, that's principle, and one's mind, because your mind combines perfect li with less than perfect qi, or the material force. But Wang Yangming disagreed. He said that principle and your heart-mind are actually the same thing. Remember, they don't distinguish between heart and mind in China. Wang Yangming said, "My own nature is, of course, sufficient for me to attain sagehood, and I have been mistaken in searching for the li in external things and affairs." So he said, if you try to learn about li, principle, through the investigation of individual things, you'll only encounter it in a fragmented way, whereas li is already complete within one's own heart-mind. So the classics and history and sages, you know, those are good, but those are only of secondary importance. True knowledge comes from looking within oneself. Okay. This is not a totally new idea in China. A man named Lu Jiuyuan, who was a contemporary and a rival of Zhu Xi in the 11th century, had said that the universe is my mind and my mind is the universe. Or even more shockingly, he said, all the classics are footnotes to me, right? So that the basic knowledge comes from within, and the classics are something that's secondary to that. Footnotes to me. Wang Yangming was also willing to take things about that far. He said, if words are examined in the mind and are found to be wrong, although they come from the mouth of Confucius, I dare not accept them as correct. Okay. Many at the time saw this as dangerous free thinking, putting one's own feelings and impressions above the classics or even above the words of Confucius himself. But Wang Yangming's ideas became popular in both China and then later in Japan, where it was taken up by some of the samurai of the 19th century who were trying to throw off tradition and modernize Japan. Wang Yangming's version of Neo-Confucianism became known as Xin Shui, which is the study of heart-mind, as opposed to Zhu Xi's Li Shui, which is the study of Li. Neo-Confucianism in general is sometimes known as Dao Shui, that's the study of the Tao, or the way, in a nod to Han Yu, who proclaimed that it was Confucianism, not Taoism, that had the true way of China. Wang Yangming added 2 key insights to the notion that mind and principle are one. The first is he taught the extension of the innate knowledge of the good. Okay, let's explain that for just a minute. Remember that in the Great Learning, it's the extension of knowledge follows the investigation of things, right? When things are investigated, then knowledge is extended. Wang Yangming looks back to Mencius' ideas of innate goodness of human nature, and he expands on that. So you start with this innate knowledge, he's going to say. It's not just goodness, and then you can extend it. So a person who sees a child about to fall into a well, remember that analogy from Mencius, he feels alarm and pity because of his natural benevolence, the humaneness that makes him identify with a child. Let me tell you where Wang Yangming goes from there. He says, similar to the case of the child, when he perceives the mournful cries and fearful trembling of birds and animals, he would certainly feel that he cannot bear it because his humaneness, his benevolence, makes him of one body with the birds and the animals, sort of identifies with living creatures. The birds and animals have consciousness, yet when he sees grass being cut, he certainly feels sympathy because his humaneness makes him of one body with the grass. But grass is alive. So you might say, well, you just identify with things that are alive. Go back to my quote. But grass is alive, yet when he sees roofing tiles and rocks smashed, he certainly feels regret because his humaneness makes him of one body with the tiles and the rocks. So notice that what we've got here is an ever-expanding circle of concern. Okay, remember what it starts from yourself and to other people and from people to animals and from animals to inanimate living objects, trees and grass, and from that to stones and material things. Remember Lu Zhouyun, who said, the universe is my mind and my mind is the universe. Okay, Wang's second insight is the unity of knowledge and action. According to the Great Learning, the plan was to first gain knowledge and then to put it into action. Wang Yangming said that those two activities are actually inseparable. He said, knowledge is the beginning of action, and action is the completion of knowledge. Okay, so knowledge gives some sort of direction, but then you can't really know something until you've actually experienced it. An example that might make sense to someone in China is like filial piety. You have to know sort of how to respect parents and why you should do that, but you don't really know filial piety until you've actually put it into practice. And if you're not being filial, you don't really know what's at stake. Or in a more modern example, you might think about exercise. Everybody knows that they ought to exercise, and it's helpful to start with knowledge, to know what kinds of activities are appropriate for your age group or why it's important, the physiological effects that it might have, and that helps you like be more effective at exercising. But unless you're actually exercising every day, you don't really know its significance or importance or what it means in your life. They have to go together. Okay, naturally, Wang Yangming didn't consider his ideas complete until he had realized them in action. Take education, for example. Zhu Xi's Neo-Confucianism often resulted in classrooms that were directed toward rote memorization and test-taking. Right? The four books, memorize them, take exams on them. Wang Yangming, having compassion for children and believing that children already possess true principle within themselves, had this advice for educators. He said, when we teach children, we must kindle their enthusiasm and make everything a joy. They will then advance of their own accord without ceasing. Sounds a little bit like Montessori learning, perhaps. Wang urged his own students to learn from the words of ordinary people. Since they also possess the innate knowledge of the good, everyone does, then it's worthwhile speaking to them and hearing what they have to say and learning of their impressions and their ideas. Wang himself spent a lot of time in intense introspection and self-criticism, so that he could learn to distinguish his good natural impulses, that innate knowledge, from selfish desires that might distort or cover them. So when you're inclined to do something, you have to ask, is this sort of my innate goodness or is this my own selfishness, self-interest, kind of getting in the way of that? Before we leave Wang Yangming, I want to point out that he is, in my opinion, one of the most personally admirable of all the great minds in this course. Wang was a great scholar and thinker, obviously, but he was also a dedicated, capable official who worked hard to make life better for the common people and who on several occasions risked his life in order to protect the weak or to criticize the powerful. As one example, early in his career, Wang wrote a memorial to the emperor on behalf of two fellow officials who had been unjustly imprisoned. In doing so, he offended a notoriously tyrannical clique at court and was himself arrested. He was beaten with 40 strokes and then sent into exile. And even then, he barely escaped the assassins that they had sent after him. When the political situation back in the capital changed and this particular group was thrown out of power, Wang was celebrated for having done the right thing at a dangerous time. Wang's life was characterized by moral courage, deep compassion, intellectual honesty and openness, and service to both society and to his country. And that included military service. He was truly a man of both knowledge and action. Okay, Let's stop here for a few general observations about Neo-Confucianism. Because Chinese culture has such a deep respect for history, the slogan, brand new, is not really a selling point. Zhu Xi, Wang Yangming, and other Neo-Confucians didn't present their ideas as innovations. They didn't say, you know, I'm the first person to ever come up with this idea. Instead, they claimed to be merely recovering the lost original meanings of Confucius and Mencius. Actually, what they've really done is devise a new holistic worldview that provides meaning for individuals, it explains the nature of the world and the cosmos, and it offers an ideology that's well-suited for government service. Like Shankara in India, they used commentaries on the classics in order to create a comprehensive synthesis of past traditions. Confucius once said, "I'm a transmitter, not an innovator." And that's exactly what Zhu Xi would have said as well. But Neo-Confucianism is a response to the challenges brought on by Taoism and Buddhism. It's more politically engaged than Taoism, and it's more optimistic and accepting of the reality of the world and social obligations than is Buddhism. In both cases, Neo-Confucianism has adapted some of the best ideas from his rivals. Remember, it brings in the great ultimate and yin-yang from Taoism, and then ideas that are a little bit like the Buddha nature, that's the qi that's in everything, or the li that's in everything, and bodhisattva-like compassion for everyone, even for non-human creatures, and quiet sitting. All of that sounds a little bit like Buddhism. It's like Neo-Confucianism is saying to people who are attracted to Buddhism, if you come back to Confucianism, we can offer you all the good things that you see in Buddhism, but it's also our native Chinese tradition. Neo-Confucianism was not exactly a religion. It certainly didn't feature a personal god, but it was like a religion in that it provided its followers with meaning in life and a path, a clear path toward a transcendent mode of being that was in harmony with the universe. Neo-Confucianism was closely connected with statecraft in late imperial China. I mean, it was basically a training program for officials because of the imperial civil service exams. As a result, when strong unified regimes came to power in Tokugawa Japan, so that's going to be from 1603 to 1868, and in Joseon Korea, and that regime lasts from 1392 to 1897, both of those, Tokugawa Japan and Joseon Korea, both of those adopted Neo-Confucianism as the official ideology there. Okay, let's conclude with a quick round of why should I care? We've seen how Neo-Confucianism's metaphysical theories of nature led to its ethical standards, but perhaps you're saying, I don't believe the cosmos is made of principle and material force, remember Li and Qi, why should I care about the rest of what they say? And here are five possible reasons. The first is, it's interesting to see how thought and culture have intersected in an Asian context. Even if Neo-Confucianism is not a live option for you, it nevertheless influenced people in East Asia for centuries, and it's still a presence today. The most prominent academic Chinese philosopher of the 20th century, his name is Feng Yolan, was a Neo-Confucian, and we'll see him again in the next lecture when we talk about Zen Buddhism. The second reason you might care, the questions Neo-Confucians asked are still with us. Can morality be based on objective facts, like the facts that are established by science? Or are ethics always a function of human culture? The 18th century Scottish philosopher David Hume argued that you can't get from is to ought. What do you think? Are some things right or wrong by nature? Maybe some other questions. What moral obligations do we owe to strangers? How should children be educated? And Neo-Confucianism has ideas about those. Third reason. Neo-Confucianism might be an example that we could use in our own arguments. Is religion necessary for morality? And Neo-Confucianism would seem to offer evidence to the contrary. Should we try to make sure that the government is staffed by the best and brightest people? And if so, how might we do that? Would competitive exams work out? And we could look to the example of Neo-Confucianism. Fourth reason. Some of the ideas of Zhu Xi and Wang Yangming are challenging and provocative. Can a person have compassion for trees and rocks as well as sentient beings? Do people really have an innate knowledge of goodness? Is there some connection between our minds and the cosmos? And what's the relationship between the mind and the heart? The Chinese, remember, don't distinguish between the two. I guess I'm on a Hume kick here, but he once said that reason is and ought only to be the slave of passions. He was willing to see mind and heart as more closely associated than sometimes people in the West do. Fifth and final reason. Some Neo-Confucian ideas and philosophers might be inspiring. I've already professed my admiration for Wang Yangming. Did I tell you that a poster with the words knowledge and action must go together hung on my kitchen wall for years? And it was something that I needed to be reminded of. But it was in Chinese so that my dinner guests couldn't look up and know what I, you know, my own personal weaknesses. Zhu Xi had a set of rules for his White Deer Grotto Academy that he posted on the wall there. They included this quotation from the Doctrine of the Mean. Remember, that's one of the four books. It said, study extensively, inquire carefully, ponder thoroughly, sift clearly, and practice earnestly. The last time I taught a course on Asian intellectual history, I put that quotation up above the blackboard all semester to motivate my own students. Whether or not you're a Neo-Confucian yourself, these are words to live by. Study extensively, inquire carefully, ponder thoroughly, sift clearly, and practice earnestly. The Japanese were certainly inspired by Neo-Confucianism, but only after going through a long period when Zen Buddhism was dominant. And we'll talk about that when we come back next time.